Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Matthew Witt. Matt is an associate professor of public administration at the University of Laverne in California. And Matt, if my memory serves me, I believe it does, you're a member of Consensus 9/11. I believe I am not mistaken in that, right?
That is correct.
It's been a while, but I bring that up because next week I'll have Elizabeth Woodworth on discussing new information on Consensus 9/11, and we'll pre-record the program on the 11th of September. It'll air when it's entered into the archives, but Elizabeth will come on to update my listeners on new developments that Consensus 9/11 has come up with and explains. And what better time to do it than on that date, Matt?
Yeah, it will remain a momentous date for many years.
Absolutely. Well beyond our lifetimes, 100 years from now, people will be talking about 9/11. And maybe by then, Matt, the real truth instead of the official big lies will be out, and people in a future generation will know what too many people today don't know. But you know the truth, and I know the truth. It certainly isn't what the original, the official story has led us to believe all these years, but that's only one of the major stories. But so much going on, Matt. Matt, you're also a valued contributor to the book that I was fortunate to be asked to be the editor of, Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risked World War III. And by the way, Matt, the book was published in France. I'm delighted to know that. And yes. I could probably read a little bit of that. I once could read French a little bit, but I've lost my ability because I haven't used it over the years. But if they send me a copy, I could read a little bit of it. We're still trying to get a Chinese publisher, and I certainly hope that may be possible. That would be very nice.
That's excellent, Stephen. And by the way, welcome back. It's excellent.
Oh, indeed. It is great to be back. And the way I like to put it, Matt, is I am just thrilled and grateful to be back doing what I love best. And that's exactly the way I feel. Not being able to write and do the media work that I love was part of my great ordeal. I mean, watching rotten television, that's not the way I want to spend my days, Matt.
You're far too valuable to everyone else to be doing that, Stephen.
Oh, indeed. But again, so many issues that are on my mind and yours too, Matt. Pick one and let's jump in and discuss it. I mean, it could be Ukraine. Sure. It could be the Gaza war. It could be Obama's new war in Iraq. It could be the horrors going on in the home front. Where do you want to jump in first, Matt?
You know, Stephen, there's a very troubling symbiosis between what's happening domestically here from Ferguson, Missouri to, you know, across the country in terms of what seems to be increasing police militarization. It doesn't seem, there's no question, as a result of the decommissioning of military materiel to police departments now for many, many years under various programs, free, by the way, that has resulted in the target hardening, as it were, of police forces across the country. And it's hard to see this as merely coincidental to the conduct of police in many instances becoming a military, an occupied force, as it were, an occupation force in the homeland. And this is an astonishing development from the standpoint of, you know, our self-concept. At the same time, of course, that the drumbeat of war across Levant and into the so-called eastern frontier of NATO countries is stepping up so dramatically. The symbiosis is something I think, it's of course not talked about at all among my tribe and academia, not at all. But that it's there is obvious to public intellectuals like yourself and others that are becoming so, so important as academia becomes increasingly irrelevant in these times. So that's on my mind.
It's on my mind too, Matt. For the most vulnerable people in America, this nation is occupied territory, and people who live in better communities don't realize what some of these people go through. I know some who have mentioned some experiences that they've had, but I live in a neighborhood of Chicago downtown, where the people here aren't harassed by the police. It could happen once in a while, but generally it is not what happens. But I could walk a mile from where I live, and the people there, the police are the enemies for good reason. Instead of serving and protecting, they harass and commit horrible abuses against people. And of course, the situation in Ferguson, Missouri, is an example where they feel that they literally have license, if they want to kill and get away with it. And I'll bet you the officer that committed cold-blooded. Well, I get more than one officer, two murders in Ferguson. I bet you the officers involved in that either get off at most with a slap on the wrist. It rarely ever comes to anything more than that.
We'll be on the verge, it seems to me, of a new season of riots like the 60s, if that occurs. So it's hard to... Well, it's challenging to visualize what's gonna materialize, but none of it's gonna be good. That's for sure. And I think that looking at the 1033 program of the Department of Defense and looking at the grants now available that have been available for some time, federal grants available for law enforcement to beef up this bizarre, a deployment. In some cases, it's really very ludicrous. So you can see the comedian newscasters like Jon Stewart making fun. John Oliver also in his new show making stinging satire of this escalation of force that is so way, way, way out of proportion to the needs and fundamental mandate to protect and serve of law enforcement. It seems to me synchronous, isomorphic to the militarization that we're seeing re-escalating into what some are calling the new Cold War, but it's with our new proxies being the resurgence of Al-Qaeda in the form of ISIS, FSA, and so on. Anyway.
Oh, indeed. Well, so much, Matt, so much. And on the homeland front, we can go overseas and talk about the issues going on there. But one of my earlier articles, not one of my earliest, maybe a couple of years or so after I began writing, I wrote an article I titled Police State America. It was a year-end review, as I recall. It might have been at the end of 2008 that I wrote that article. Maybe it was at the end of 2007. I address the issue at the federal level, not the state and local level, but the fact that police state laws following 9/11 have really turned America into a police state. So it is no exaggeration to say a police state apparatus runs America, and Obama took all of the Bush laws and presidential executive orders and so on, and exacerbated them with more of his own, so that literally any American can be arrested by the U.S. military, thrown in a military prison, left there uncharged forever. If that's the determination of the federal authorities, that can go on. If this isn't a good definition of tyranny, I don't know what is.
It's absolutely remarkable. It's hard to look at it, except you can either laugh in some ways at how ludicrous is our fall from grace with our founding promise and covenant you know, or you can look at it with a kind of horror, I guess. It seems such an orchestrated, you know, this relatively seamless transition from war on terror to war on the home front, the militarization of the most basic law enforcement, you know, utilizing SWAT teams routinely for delivering warrants for drug possession or suspected drug possession. SWAT teams. And a message that sends to communities as doors are knocked down and helmeted and armored personnel enter armed with automatic weapons, you know, to deliver warrants on people having breakfast. Maybe they smoked a joint the night before. It's just, it's astonishing, Stephen. It's just so astonishing. And I think just staying on this for a minute, and then let's flip to the international scene. The police tactics, for instance, that were on display in Occupy, they originated with training and maneuvers that Urban Shield 2011, which was an annual SWAT team exposition hosted in Alameda County, law enforcement. Those tactics were intended to coordinate mutual response among and between law enforcement strike forces. And the law enforcement magazine Police, just it's called Police, posted online late November in 2011, a synopsized account of the role that Urban Shield played in Oakland and Berkeley. You recall those violent roundups during the Occupy period. And Urban Shield wrote, or Police Magazine wrote, after the evictions, protesters returned en masse, allegedly. I'm saying allegedly in brackets, to battle police by throwing rocks, bottles, and paint. Police responded with chemical and less lethal munitions. Chemical munitions. That's against the law. And then ultimately they write, the Oakland mayor allowed the protesters to return to their tent city. But the article adds that this incident was, quote, reminiscent of the Vietnam War, where military tactics often played out as take a hill, give it back. This is from Police Magazine. Mm. And the story, it closes by sizing up how complex events, quote-unquote, like the Occupy movement, require the, quote-unquote, seamless cooperation that Urban Shield can provide. And then it closes on this ominous note. Such teamwork just may be the most significant and valuable thing about Urban Shield. Given today's continuing sour economy, it's predictable that law enforcement is becoming increasingly reliant on mutual aid response to handle the more complex events. So now, end quote, so now social unrest as a result of crippling economic problems for the most increasing numbers of vulnerable people have become, quote-unquote, complex events. And that's, again, indicative, but that it's so sort of openly, brazenly talked about in the industry rags serving police departments is again, it's just another indication. Anyway, that's all I got on that, Steve.
Well, there's so much going on the home front. It's been a while since I've written about NSA spying, Matt. I wrote an awful lot about it during the headlines featuring Edward Snowden on a regular basis, but I haven't written about it lately. I mean, everybody is spied on, and they can spy on you very easily, and they certainly take full advantage of it. You know, the homeland population is the enemy, and the big lies about no we don't do any of this. Well, of course, it's done all the time and continues to be done. Yeah, and they do anything they want, Matt, at home and abroad, and seem to be able to get away with it because nobody does anything to stop them. But let's go overseas. Certainly Ukraine remains a major, major issue for me. I've written almost daily articles on it since I came back. And yesterday, Vladimir Putin presented a very, very sensible, fair-minded peace plan. I wrote about it, made some comments of my own, and I simply listed the proposal, 7 points, the proposals that he met. If you took his name on it and you put somebody from the State Department on it who really wanted peace, I don't think you find anybody in the State Department at a high level that wants peace or any other U.S. Department. I mean, they want war. They don't want peace. But if you put a Western name on it instead of Vladimir Putin, it would probably get a lot of praise as to how to end this conflict and bring peace. I mean, very fair-minded, not taking sides, just equity and justice for all sides involved. And, of course, as expected, Putin was pilloried unfairly. His words were twisted. He was all kinds of vilification came down on him, and I wrote a follow-up article this morning on just saying that. And there was even some contradiction in the. Between the State Department and the White House, with Obama just point blank accusing Russia of sending troops across the border in tanks and the rest of it, artillery and so on. And the State Department at first equivocating over it on Tuesday, saying, oh, well, they really don't have any confirming information about some of this, and then lying and saying they never said anything about that on Wednesday, going along pretty much with what Obama said. But some good reporters held the State Department spokesman to account, saying, and also the State Department spokesman refusing to use the word invasion, which Obama uses and other U.S. officials use, and her only comment, she ducked the question when she was asked why she doesn't use the word invasion. This is Jen Psaki. She ducked the question, saying, well, it really doesn't matter what we call it.
Right.
Well, if you're not calling it invasion, probably there's no invasion that took place.
Yeah. Holy smoke, you know. At a press briefing recently, Obama's press secretary spoke, I made mention recently, of the Eastern Frontier, the NATO's Eastern Frontier, and that's such loaded terminology, it seems to me. He said, he spoke, the United States, in cooperation with our allies, plans to significantly increase the readiness of NATO response force to ensure that the alliance is prepared to respond to threats in a timely fashion. This will involve training exercises and discussions about what kinds of infrastructure will be required in the Baltics, Poland, and Romania, and other states in the eastern frontier to deal with the world in which they face new concerns about Russian intentions. This is such loaded language.
Oh, indeed it is, Matt. Right now, as we speak, there is a summit going on, a NATO summit going on in Wales. It is an anti-Russian NATO summit. The promoters of it call it the most important one in many years, and the idea behind this summit is to come up with initiatives to target Russia. A so-called brigade-sized rapid reaction force will be part of what comes out of this summit, no doubt. Also, more sanctions against Russia, which hurt both sides equally. They make no sense whatsoever, especially in Europe, that has an immense amount of trade with Russia. American trade with Russia is very small compared to European trade, especially Germany. And the idea that they would shoot themselves in the foot to go along with U.S. policies makes no sense to me. And European corporations are absolutely furious about this stuff going on. They're losing business. And Russia won't sit back and not respond, and nor should they. And I've said it many times and written many times. It certainly is in the Flashpoint in Ukraine book that Russia certainly is not guilty of the things it's accused of. The Ukraine story is really American imperialism on the march, deposing a democratically elected government, installing illegitimate neo-Nazi-infested fascist to replace them. They literally have no legitimacy whatsoever. And the oligarch president of Ukraine, I keep wanting to say Afghanistan, of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, is really just a U.S. He's a U.S. proxy. He's an imperial tool. He pretty much goes along with what America wants. Kiev is infested with CIA and FBI operatives. I think U.S. Special Forces are there as well. Maybe they're in eastern Ukraine helping the Ukrainian army that hasn't been doing too well these days, Matt. They're getting their ears pinned back by a guerrilla force absolutely determined to fight for the democracy they deserve. And the Ukrainian military, most of the ones there, don't want to be there. They want to be home. And so many of them can't understand why they're sent to another part of the country to wage war on their own people. And a lot of them have defected, or they crossed the border for sanctuary in Russia. And this is the stuff that never gets reported in the U.S. media. But if you read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post on a daily basis, I always check what they're saying about the issues I'm concerned about online. You just see one big lie repeated after another, a Russian invasion. And Russia firing artillery from cross-border and from within Ukrainian territory. They don't mention that the weapons southeastern Ukrainians, the self-defense forces I call freedom fighters, they don't mention the fact that they've gotten a lot of their weapons from Ukrainian soldiers who have just given up and left and abandoned their weapons, and the freedom fighters are picking them up and using them. And I'm talking about artillery and tanks, and the only help that's coming from abroad are volunteers from a number of countries, including some retired Russian military personnel, including some Russian active duty personnel, on leave, using their leave time to come for a couple of weeks or so to help self-defense forces, and they themselves admit this is going on, but there are no Russian active duty troops. There are none sent by the Russian government. There is no invasion. There are no weapons and munitions being supplied. The self-defense forces can get all they want when the Ukrainian forces abandon them. And when Washington or Kiev or whoever, the Pentagon or NATO, show videos of Russian tanks or Russian artillery, what they don't mention is the weapons used in this area are pretty much all Russian-made, and they have been for many years. So the freedom fighters are using it. The Kiev military is using it. These are the weapons that have floated around this area for many, many years. But again, Russia is the good guy in this conflict. The peace proposal that Putin laid out was very, very sensible, but of course completely mocked, debunked. He's accused of the opposite of what he intends, and the war no doubt will go on, and I very eagerly await, Matt, to see what comes out of this NATO summit. I don't know what we'll hear at the end of the session today. I don't know how many hours they'll be in session. I think it's going to run about a day and a half, so maybe tomorrow afternoon we'll get reports on exactly what they came up with, and there's no question I'll be writing about it.
Stephen, do you see any the emergence of any kind you mentioned, for instance, the German commercial and industrial interests being, undermined by this neoliberal agenda, and I'm curious how, if they are furious, in what ways, and how it is they haven't gotten on board. In other words, I'm wondering what are the cleavages in the cleavages in the agenda, the neoliberalized U.S.-British Axis agenda in Europe that could emerge, right, and become a form of resistance itself you see anything like that?
Well, I think the business interests love war because they make so much money out of it, and I'm not just talking about the weapons and munitions makers. But on the other hand, the sanctions cut both ways, so the businesses are being hurt. You know, cutting off some American agricultural exports, imports into Russia. I mean, this hurts agricultural interests. This talk about Russia banning U.S. auto imports. My God, could you imagine the uproar among the U.S. auto companies if that happened?
Well, okay. So there will be uproar, but it will be muted, or those interests will be got to and calmed down, I presume. I'm wondering if there's any kind of alliances that would emerge as a result of the sanctions. But I'm just out of my depth there, my area.
I'm not aware of any, Matt. But obviously the businesses in America and across Europe, they're closely connected because they meet each other. They have some of their people on each other's boards of directors. So they're very closely tied. So and what affects one can affects some in one area can affect others in different areas. But at the same time, Europe is mostly vulnerable to the sanctions wars with Russia, where America isn't so much. But yet, if any particular company in America gets badly harmed, they don't want to lose business. They want to look for opportunities to increase business. And the sanctions wars literally go the opposite way. And it's crazy, but we're going to see more sanctions imposed on Russia. And for some reason, the European leaders go against their own interests, the interests of their own economies. And they're doing it at a time right now, Matt, where the European economies are very fragile. Europe is heading into another recession. So you do something to harm business, and you're going to exacerbate the recession. And businesses, I think, are extremely concerned about that. And what affects Europe certainly will affect America to some extent. It'll affect the world, and you could say what affects America affects the world. So these things are just lunatic policies, and yet that's what's going to come out of the NATO summit. Just what's announced, I don't know, but we've seen a number of rounds of sanctions. We're going to see more. But what concerns me most, Matt, is doing anything of a belligerent nature, whether it's establishing a rapid reaction force, whether it's sending 10,000 NATO troops to Eastern European countries against a supposed Russian threat that does not exist. There is no Russian threat whatsoever. But these are the things that can get out of control. And we can see what begins as a spark turn into a conflagration. There could be a major East-West confrontation, which is what I mention in my articles all the time. I mean, we had a world war in 1914. You know, never again after that war, the war to end all wars. And 20 years later, a second world war. Is it unreasonable to imagine we can't have a third world war? Well, I'll tell you, what's going on now, Matt, is in many respects reminiscent of what led up to World War One, and it really looks like there's a possibility we could have something really big breaking out, and the weapons that are around today make the earlier ones look like toys. It's very serious business. I mean, I just can't conceive of a nuclear war, but the possibility is there.
It's difficult to disagree. I don't have any basis for disagreement. I think, Stephen, I mean that the elements for global war are clearly in place, and you know, the temperature rising, as it were. It's very, very good point. Well, the encirclement of Russia, I think, is so clearly in play, and the not-so-veiled threats that ISIS will emerge in the Caucasus and surrounding areas to threaten Russia, this sort of veiled messaging by U.S. think tanks, that Russia has more to be concerned about in its southern flank than in Ukraine, I mean, this is messaging, it seems to me, similar to Chile in 73, when there mysteriously appeared as graffiti in Santiago, Suharto's coming. A cryptic threat indicating that that type of military junta was on its way, and where it would come from, right? It was cryptic and ominous. But it seems to me similar messaging is occurring now for Putin. ISIS is on its way. And given the scope of the geography, your point about world war seems to me hardly an exaggeration. It seems a sober assessment of real possibility.
It's very real, Matt. The big issue is what the Pentagon calls full-spectrum dominance, that America literally wants control over everything, unchallenged control over everything, land, sea, air, space, information, you name it, and wants all challenges removed. So every independent country is vulnerable to America targeting it for regime change. When America goes to war against another nation, whether it's Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, you name it, it's because it's an independent government that America wants to replace with a pro-Western stooge one. That's the kind of government that America wants, and it's the same situation. The final frontier for America is Russia and China. These are the two major rivals of America, and America wants them marginalized and co-opted and contained and turned into just two more U.S. vassal states. But certainly you're not going to go after those two countries easily. And if both of them unite, which they are really doing, they certainly are doing it in trade. I believe it was back in May, I wrote about the major Russian gas deal, Russian-Chinese gas deal, huge deal that nobody really knows how many billions of dollars it'll amount to, but it's a three-decade deal where Russia will supply China with enormous amounts of natural gas it needs and oil as well, and this is huge. But Russia and China are coming together in a unified economic and political way that will present an even greater challenge to America's desire for unchallenged dominance, and other countries might join in that simply resent the fact that America wants subservience of all nations in the world to its agenda. They want to develop their economies. They don't want to go off and fight wars, which of course is the NATO agenda. What I call a killing machine, and indeed it is a killing machine. And NATO wants to be more than just a North Atlantic alliance. It wants to be a global alliance. And even today, Matt, with NATO members and partners, as they call themselves, NATO is comprised of one-third of the nations of the world. And again, NATO wants to be a global force, literally with virtually all countries part of NATO. And I call it U.S. NATO because America today funds about three-fourths of NATO's budget. So America calls the shots. And when you hear about NATO, you're really hearing about America's agenda. And, of course, the key countries, Britain, France, Germany, they go along with these horrors, and they'll be pushed to the limit in Brussels today and tomorrow to go along with what America wants to do in Ukraine or any place else. But the thing, again, that scares me, Matt, is the idea that we could see an open confrontation that could really be a very serious war that could make the others we've seen post 9/11 seem very minor by comparison. I sure hope that doesn't happen.
What do you make of the BRICS Development Bank as a feature of this stepped up aggression by the U.S.
Targeting the development bank?
Well, that the development bank is now in place for the BRICS countries, and that kind of effrontery to the global economic order, otherwise determined by Western institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. But to what extent do you see that development as relevant to the current military movement.
I wrote about it once. It's been a good while, and I think it's still in its infancy. But anything that would challenge the U.S. financial system, Matt, would certainly get the attention of Washington or challenge the hegemony of the U.S. dollar. Well, one thing very much is taking place is more countries are trading with each other in their own currencies. And the big deal with the gas deal, Russia with China, and other U.S.-Chinese trade is, to a large extent, and I think entirely, maybe before too long, they will be trading with each other in their own currencies going around the U.S. dollar. And this literally drives Washington crazy. And other countries are doing it as well. I mean, the hegemony of the U.S. dollar is a very important linchpin that lets America carry on its aggressive foreign policy. And you knock some of the underpinnings of that dollar out, and it really puts a crimp in the U.S. dollar, but also go at the Federal Reserve. You got alternative banking systems. You knock the underpinnings apart out from under the Federal Reserve. I can only dream of they being knocked out entirely, Matt.
Well, of course, in the short term of these sort of dismantling forces, there's tremendous hardship experienced by the innocent, or the nominally innocent. I'm thinking now of what would happen with to follow out the scenarios you're describing, there's going to be, at the very least, significant rising costs for the basics for Americans. Fixed and limited income people are going to be increasingly in serious trouble. And that, of course, is going to lead to more of the substantiation of perspectives like what I gave of Police Magazine. More complex events will emerge in the country that will warrant more seamless cooperation between law enforcement and military think tank domestic organization. So, which serves this Orwellian logic. It serves a kind of logic that's going to be, if I follow your reasoning and sort of my own thinking, is going to be increasingly evident. I mean, with this tilt, getting back to the BRICS, to what extent those nations, Russia, China, Brazil, India, and allied states, to what extent they're calculating, or they calculated the risks incurred for doing this, you know, surely they realized that U.S. interests would be greatly threatened by the effrontery that this would, bringing the BRICS bank online would indicate, and that this had a very real downside risk of exactly what the U.S. is doing now. And so for that matter, I wonder, in their assessments, if they have just assumed there's no way that the U.S. could possibly muster a real offensive that would threaten China and Russia. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Well, I would just add to that, Matt, that unity is the best offense against America, or the best defense. You could look at it in both respects.
Okay, this is the point I'm looking for. Yeah.
And other countries may join the alliance. Maybe they'll have to come up with a new name. But there are other independent countries like Iran, certainly Syria, although they're going through the terrible problems with Obama's war against them. Absolutely, Obama's war, a proxy war, using ISIS as an ally against the Syrian people. But there are independent countries, including in South America. You've got them. You've got them in other parts of the world. And if you could get independent countries aligning together against the hegemonic interests of America, they can only do them harm in the long run. That is the best offense and defense against the American system that is causing so much hardship and so much grief to so many, and threatening, literally threatening humanity. And somehow a way has to be found to stop this. Heaven only knows what could happen. The notion of a nuclear war, very, very possible. But again, the horrors that America commits in the name of democracy, a humanitarian intervention, whatever characterization they want to give it, If countries unify against this, it's the best way to stop it.
Meantime, there's the wild card of nuclear, of a nuclear incident.
The likelihood of one?
Well, I'm characterizing it as a wild card because it seems to me that if the U.S. if U.S. interests become too threatened by a global alliance that begins hemming us in, hemming the U.S. in, then what? A teetering giant is a very dangerous player.
I think a nuclear war is a wild card, Matt, and at the same time, you could look at World War One and Two and call those events wild cards, but they happened. And what went on secretly that maybe we haven't learned about with all the research that's been done, maybe there were more dark forces doing more planning for something global than we realize. But September 1, by the way, was the anniversary. September 1. The anniversary of World War II, and it was just about the day that I entered kindergarten, but as a five-year-old at the time, I had no idea what was going on, and there was no television in those days, and it took me a little while before I realized what was happening. Well, of course, it wasn't a world war at that point. That was when Hitler invaded Poland, and there was a quiet period after that, and then the invasion of France and so on and so forth, and by December 7th, 1941, America got into the war, which it wanted to get into, and we had World War II with a lot of my family members in it, and they all came back safe and sound, thank heavens. But we had that horrible event, which I absolutely remember so vividly, even with no television till well after the war was over in the later 1940s. But you could get plenty on radio. It's amazing what you could get on radio that could be so vivid in explaining what was happening, and you didn't get the kind of news then that you get now. But I think there were better accounts of what was going on. But I certainly do remember that vividly, Matt. And I just can't imagine that the idea that we would live through this again, and yet it's very possible.
When you say the horrible event, you mean Pearl Harbor?
Pearl Harbor certainly was a horrible event, and it was one that Franklin Roosevelt wanted. And I mean, part of the true story of Pearl Harbor was America tracked the Japanese fleet across the Pacific, saw it was heading for Pearl Harbor, did not warn the commander, I think his name was Kimmel, because Roosevelt needed a Pearl Harbor-type event to turn peace-loving Americans into German and Japanese hating war supporters, and he got the event he wanted, and bingo, we were in World War II, and that's exactly the way it happened. In World War One, Woodrow Wilson, with his Creel Commission, turned pacifist Americans into raging German haters. That was the first time that propaganda was really used on a very extensive basis. It took about 6 months, but Americans absolutely wanted no part of war then. They wanted no part of the war that turned into World War II, but the propaganda machine, and of course, the Pearl Harbor event was what enlisted fear and got Americans on the side of the war, just the way 9/11 got the American people to support Bush's wars on Afghanistan and then Iraq until they got to be quagmires and then everything changed.
Well, I think this is, and that was the point I was waiting, the connection I was waiting for, the David Ray Griffin. It was a joint author with Peter Falk, I think, under title The New Pearl Harbor.
Oh, The New Pearl Harbor, yeah.
Characterizing 9/11 that way. And that was the title of a book that came out now 10 years ago, I think.
Oh, you're talking about David Ray Griffin.
David Ray Griffin.
And he's written 10 books. He's written 10 books on 9/11. The New Pearl Harbor was the first one. He wrote one of the 9/11. I can't keep track of all the books he's written on 9/11, but he wrote 10 of them. And David really is an extraordinary man. A retired religion professor, and yet he got on the 9/11 story, and nobody has told it more honestly and in greater detail that people need to know about than David. He also, David also went through some physical problems after a surgery that that caused a stroke and caused him aphasia. Otherwise, he would be the guest on 9/11 this time. And David really backs off from interviews now because he can't speak the way he could before. And it's he can do it, but the words don't come out as easily as they did before he had the problem. But David is a world hero for what he's done. And Elizabeth Woodworth, who'll be on this program next week, is a very close associate with David. So she and others will represent him, and they do a wonderful job. Elizabeth has been on this program before.
Yeah, they together are the they together, Elizabeth and David are the as it were, the stewards of the Consensus 9/11 initiative.
Matt, I'll tell you one thing that's been on my mind lately. It's been 13 years since 9/11. And look what Obama is doing. I mean, he's still in Afghanistan. I don't know what's going to happen there, despite the promises. He just launched another war against Iraq. He's got everything going on in Ukraine that could develop into something much bigger than it is now. And the polls show that the vast majority of Americans want the wars ended and they want America's resources used for domestic needs. It strikes me that this would be an ideal time for another 9/11 type event to strike fear into the hearts of the American people, again with another big lie, and get them on board for more war. Now, I don't know that it'll happen, but it seems like this would be a very strategic time for another 9/11 type event.
The point is very well taken, and again, one can imagine any number of scenarios that are on the shelf as we speak to come out of mysteriously materialized. And I think that, the Boston incident, the Boston Marathon incident.
Oh, yes.
So loaded with press contradictions and ellipses in continuity of reporting and dead end leads from claims that were specious in the first place. Just that, and I think also the spate of shootings that have similarly received a whole bunch of media sensationalism, but when you start looking at the reporting, there's some really troublesome facets to those shootings. More shootings, in my account, have occurred under Obama, these crazy shootings, so-called lone gunman, nut job shootings under Obama than I can ever remember happening in scores of years before him. And that seems to me a harbinger. It seems to me a harbinger that we are being prepared. We're being increasingly stunned as a people, ready for another Pearl Harbor event. And I think that it would be, the timing is ominous.
The timing is ominous, Matt. I don't think a lot has been played up about the beheading of two U.S. journalists. I don't think that's quite big enough to take the nation to a major war against another country, even though these things get headlines and they get repeated all the time. I think it'll take something much, much bigger than that. But you could take a little incident, you could add more little incidents, and then you could have a whopping big incident, and you could get you could get an increasingly angry public going extremely angry and getting on board for something they absolutely should oppose. And this is the way the propaganda machine works. You literally manipulate the minds of the public. You manipulate them with big lies. And going back to Boston for a moment, my home city, I know exactly where the incident took place. My God, in the old days, I was there enough times. But two innocent kids got framed for something they had nothing to do with. One was shot to death. The other will go on trial. He'll be convicted. Yeah. There's no question about that. And what bothered me so much in writing about what happened, several articles that I wrote, was that there was a complete lockdown, a police state lockdown of Boston, with police and FBI raiding homes pre-dawn and so forth. And the people who were affected by this, asked to come out in the street or let the agents come into their homes, they went along with all of this, thinking it was all being done to protect them. So these police state horrors that were being inflicted on this, on them, and they thought it was being done for their benefit. And that scares me, Matt. It shows you that the public mind can be manipulated so severely in the wrong direction that this country can get away with anything.
So there's the willingness in that, I'm glad you brought that up, the willingness of people in Boston after that incident to suspend their own civil liberties.
Yes.
Fast forward to Ferguson, and you have black people, in this case, a majority of the community that are occupied in an apartheid-like police culture. They are, you know, demonstrating fidelity with our founding values, but they're stigmatized as a rabble, stigmatized as, you know, I mean, it's astounding. You know, the governor coming out and declaring a state of emergency for people who are in a peaceful protest. And so there's this transference of, well, from you know, rebels everywhere to rebels among us, it seems to me.
Oh, indeed, and so, Matt. The enemy is us. The old Pogo statement, we've met the enemy, and it's us. Well, there's no question. The enemy of the American public and of peoples around the world is the U.S. government, and Obama is the man there now. But of course, you've got the Congress, you've got the courts, and you've got the state and local authorities. We have a horrible situation in Chicago with the unindicted war criminal as the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel. Unfortunately, my mayor, although the polls show he's not doing too well, so maybe there'll be a new mayor in the next election. I'm not quite certain when that is. But in my 45 years in Chicago, we have never had a good one. I came here in the old Mayor Daley days, and then his son took over for 10 or 12 years, and there were a couple of others thrown in, and I even bumped into a couple of them. I'll skip that story. A couple of them, after they came out of office, one with Jane Byrne, who I think is still my neighbor across the street. Haven't seen her in quite some time. But the administration of Chicago is really terrible. But it's the same thing in other cities around the country and the state government. And people are terribly abused. And there's certainly no opposition to the policies that come out of Washington, especially the imperial ones, except that the states and the cities want more money.
Right, right. It's murky where Occupy originated, the Occupy initiative, and there's some Michelle Kalsadowski over at the Global Research wrote a really, really important piece now. It's been several months, I think, since you wrote it, linking the symbolism, the fist associated with Occupy, to a similar imagery used by CIA-backed jihadist groups, and openly speculating whether Occupy was a ginned-up initiative. Not that there weren't an awful lot of sincere people, of course, who became affiliated with it and with, you know, genuine intention, but that Occupy was intended to create precedent again for the American public. It's not accepting a militarized, you know, crackdown, anyway willing to permit it to occur. And that Occupy became a staging, as much a two-way staging, you know, a way of dramatizing what will happen when when there is when these complex events become more frequent as a result of declining fortunes for America.
I met with some of the Occupy Chicago people, Matt. It's been a good while, a long time ago now, and I discussed the possibility of getting an invitation to come down and addressing one of their meetings. And I forget the frequency at which they held them, but they had maybe it was weekly meetings with special things would be discussed. And I asked whether I could get an invitation to come down and present my thoughts to the group at some time. And I seemed to enlist some interest among the people I spoke to, but the invitation was never forthcoming, and I never had a chance to go down at one of these special meetings, not on the street, but at some kind of an assembly point where they met and discussed the things that were on their mind. That would have been a wonderful experience. It would have given me a chance to explain things as I see them and maybe generate even a little bit more interest and activity in the importance of what I think a lot of good people involved in it wanted to do. Just exactly what happened. Certainly, the movement faded to a large extent, and I don't know exactly what's going on now.
I don't either. I don't either. I do wonder, though, to what extent it was more, you know, sort of dramaturgy that was instrumental for the purposes of legitimating increasing militarized occupation.
Oh, indeed, man. I was so encouraged when the movement began in New York, and it spread like wildfire across
Many
the country, big cities,
right.
Small towns. I mean, I thought that was incredible. I said, this is a game changer. This is a game changer.
Yeah, sure.
Well,
right?
I was wrong.
Well, I think it did. It certainly stirred up an awful lot of awareness and a lot of commentary that I think was in some ways really valuable. But it's that old, you know, sort of wait for the other shoe to drop, you know, that and the other shoe to drop was again the legitimation of this militarized police occupation and the sort of spectacle that all of the middle class, you know, NewsHour watching, you know, Democracy Now consuming liberal public, you know, is watching this and realizing either they won't do anything or they can't do anything. And that has a terribly numbing effect. You might as well say that Suharto is coming.
Oh, indeed, man.
We're coming
just about
back to
this.
I keep coming.
People don't realize the power they have if they'll only use it. I mean, collective power can really be very special when it's used for the right things. Matt, we're coming to the end of the program. Just about a minute or so left. Some final thoughts?
Final thoughts, gee, let's keep paying attention. I'm so thankful, Stephen, you're back online. I look forward to seeing your work online. And keep people talking, Stephen.
Well, I intend to do that, Matt. I just can't imagine spending my time doing anything else. It's what I missed so much when I was unable to be involved like this. But I'm thrilled and I'm grateful to be back and able to write and host this program and take interviews that I get asked to do. And the big issues, Matt, that you're concerned about and I'm concerned about. And I look forward to getting you back on this program again to discuss whatever is making the headlines at that point in time, Matt. It was great having you on, and I truly do look forward to having you back.
Always a pleasure, Stephen. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, bye-bye.